My name is Hugh Agro. I'm the president and CEO of Revival Gold, the Bear Track Arnett Gold Project in Idaho, the western U.S. state of Idaho, and now the Merkur Project in the western U.S. state of Utah.
We are going to talk about that here in a second, and we're going to talk about raising money as well. But first of all, I'm loving the merch. well done.
We'll get you outfitted. We'll get you outfitted, Matt. Yes.
I want to be outfitted. I only wear quality merch from quality companies, so I look forward to that. Right, Hugh, let's talk about the news of the moment, which is obviously you are acquiring Ensign Minerals and concurrently doing a $7 million equity financing. So why this deal? What's it do for you?
Yeah, it's a furtherance of our strategy to create the go-to name in the United States with now 6.2 million ounces of resource. Third largest endowment amongst developers, our peers in the Western U.S. But more importantly, it accelerates our path to heap leach gold production, and it will allow us to get to a bigger scale, a target production of 150,000 ounces between these projects. So lots of good reasons to do this deal. We've looked at a lot of different things. Last time we spoke, Matt, I said that we were looking very hard on the corporate development front to change the game on Revival Gold. This does it, and in spades.
Well, lots of people tell me that, but you actually got to do it. So, like, that's why I'm intrigued by this. And I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head there, which to my next question, which is, I asked, what does it do for you? It's scale. What feedback have you been getting which sort of kind of drove this need to do this? Was it just pure and simple scale, or was it proximity to production, or was it a whole kind of the U.S. factor? What was driving it?
Well, it's both the two things at the start. It's getting more scale. So being at that target 150,000 ounces a year from heap leach, which remember that's a simpler process to get through than our mill ounces at Bear Track Arnett. Lots of potential to do that and carry forward our production to higher levels. But we wanted to move to a higher scale with that heap leach production and also with the overall resource base. We're increasing the resource of heap leach gold with this transaction by over 60%, and we're giving up just one-third of our market cap to do that. So this is transformative, creative in that sense. And that's why this is important to us.
Okay. Now, I was talking this morning on the show with a lawyer and a banker, and we're talking about M&A, and the fact there will be a lot more M&A transactions happening in the marketplace. And they'll do different things for different people. I think one of the aspects was in terms of the integration and synergies and the kind of, the 2+2=5. Component. When you're looking at something like this, what were you looking for? And tell us what you think you've got.
Well, if you sit back and you look at what Revival Gold strategy has been all about, it's really been all about looking for gold where gold has been found and mined before. So that's box number one. Box number two is to pursue these brownfield sites where we can get efficiency and where we've got supportive communities. That's box number two. And then box number three is around this synergy of operation and having a single team, not two teams, having a single location, not two different countries and different time zones. And so those are tough boxes for us to check. We've looked at, well over 150 different opportunities. This one is a private company, so it's the first time public. So there's efficiencies in that for us. And the pro forma company is valued at just $7 an ounce in the ground. So, when we give up shares on good value, we want to make sure we're giving up those shares for something that brings equivalent value and upside. So we ticked that box as well. A lot of box ticking going on here with this transaction. And if you think about the other aspect of what we've done at Bear Track Arnett, this taking over these projects with legacy data, one of the big jobs that our team's going to go through is to take over 50 boxes of drill logs and exploration data and put that into the digital format so that we're in the modern era of science around modeling and looking for opportunity and de-risking the project going forward. So that's a big step for us. and a synergistic aspect for us because we know how to do that really well.
Okay, but tell me what you've got though, because the private companies, not a lot of data out there. Your press release is quite good and full. Some people should totally go there and read a bit more detail. But tell me what you've got and what you think you've got to do to kind of move it through the phases relatively quickly.
Starting point is a over 6,000 hectares, some 15,000 acre land position that's been knitted together over the last 8 years. Again, very common with what we did at Bear Track Arnett, right? It's not just the legacy Barrick Mercer operation, but it's the other limb of the fold. And this was one of the first identified Carlin trend type deposit, Carlin type deposits in the Western United States. And we know there's a lot of potential because it sits next to the likes of Bingham Canyon. It sits next to a couple other gold mines, produced over 50 million ounces of gold in their past. So lots of gold production from this area, lots of exploration potential around it. And so we're bringing this in, and that land position is the starting point of what we get. Next, the resource, 1.6 million ounces of gold at 0.6 grams per ton gold. It's pure gold. Another common feature with Bear Track Arnett, what we've put together there. These are 100% gold projects. The other aspect about this project is it's on a good setting. It's got power to site. It's got road, paved road right up to site. And we're about an hour from a town of 40,000 people. So supportive community, source of labor and leadership in a really good location. Finally, it's on private land. So what we're getting here is private land. That means we can avoid going through the federal NEPA permitting process. And it's a very dry area, arid, semi-arid landscape, which is very good for us because that means we can we don't have to do all that baseline data collection around water. And we don't have to worry about building water retention, water treatment. That makes this a much quicker path to production. So we're getting a lot for the plus or minus 21 million Canadian of shares that we're giving up. Creative transaction, faster pace to production, and it's growing our overall scope and scale to that 150,000 ounces of target heap leach production.
Right. Okay. So you constructed it initially so that the money that you do raise and the money that you do have, you're able to allocate to both projects, and I'm sure you'll describe, you know, how are you going to allocate that capital. But just on the transaction itself, when you exercise the Mercure options, you're going to have to, there's a kind of process of, well, there's $5 million there and then, you know, three further stage payments after that. So just tell us about why that worked for them, and we clearly know why it works for you. How do those conversations go? What do they see in the future for you and your shares?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because one of the things that we wanted to do in this transaction was make sure that we had a runway to get to production without having a big $20 million bullet payment before we got there. And we reorganized with Ensign the transaction with Barrick. And as you point out, we have a $5 million payment for all this infrastructure. We're getting all this data, a $5 million payment in January 2026. And then the subsequent payments will come out of future cash flow from the operation, total of $5 million each, separated by a year each.
Right.
But again, okay. Once we're in production.
Once you're in production, yeah, on the first, second, and third anniversary of production. Barrick is still involved, though. You know, Barrick have got, I think they've got an NSR on this. They have a bit of stock as well. Now you've sort of come together. Now you've, hopefully this gets clearly voted through and over the line, and the paperwork is signed and done and dusted. You know, Barrick still has some ability here to sell down stock, do they? Is that an overhang for you, or have you been in conversations with that?
No, they don't own any stock, so there isn't a risk of sale of stock. Actually, it's a warrant.
A
warrant, which if all 4 million warrants are exercised, that puts another $1 million into the company.
Right, okay.
It does mean 4 million more shares outstanding, but we see that as a win-win because, of course, it aligns Barrick with us. And in respect to the royalties, it's just under 2%, about 1.9% on the current resource of an NSR royalty. And so again, that ensures that, you know, we've got a partnership with Barrick as opposed to, you know, a misalignment of interests. They'll want to see us move into production and from this site that is in really good shape. And the relationship there and the discussions around doing that, managing the site are all very constructive. So this is, and again, this is something we know how to do well, right? We've got some, on our board, we've got, you know, ex-Barrick, ex-Pan American people. We've got Norm Pitcher joining us from Ensign, former Pan American exec, former COO at Eldorado. And these big companies like Barrick, like Pan American, take comfort in knowing we've got a quality technical team, good governance and leadership, and that we're going to do a good job with these assets and deliver value for them ultimately.
Okay, right. Okay, so thanks for clearing up the detail on shares and warrants. But obviously, Ensign signed in an option agreement to pick this up, this asset up from Barrick. So had Barrick done much? Do you have much data which you can utilize?
And we have too much data. There's a lot of data. I think I alluded to it earlier. There's about 50 boxes of drill logs, assay information, metallurgical information. That's the immediate focus for our team. And it's going to take us several months to go through all of that, digitize it, get it into into the model, the electronic model of the resource, the geology, the geochemistry. And we've got some really good people leading that charge. John Meyer, our VP Engineering and Development on the engineering side, Steve Priestmeier on the data side, the QAQC, our VP Exploration, and that effort, you know, that's a duplicate of the effort that we've already done at Baratrek. So we know how to do that, and there's lots of information to work for. A lot of low hanging fruit will come from that. Kind of just to put that into perspective, you know. When you've got 100-150 kilometers of drilling data that you can work with, imagine what that would cost to replace at all in costs in the United States of you know, $300 or $400 an ounce, $300 or $400 a meter of RC drilling. You know, you're talking about $60 million worth of value just in the data to replicate it.
Let's talk about. So I want to understand if this is going to be smooth sailing or is this a long, drawn-out process, right? So you talked about it being a private land earlier and, you know, surrounded by, you know, state leases, federal claims, et cetera. In terms of doing business on private land, the difference, I guess, is night and day in a way. But what are the kind of restrictions on you, that the things that you're going to need to start working on now to be able to, again, advance the project?
The resource is entirely on private ground, which means the difference between having to go through a federal U.S. permit for permitting, that's NEPA, National Environmental Protection Agency, or a state agency in Utah, that's DOGMA. And the other difference for us is, and I talked about it already a couple of times, but water. Water is the primary issue around mining in the Western United States because there's not enough of it, and we got to look after it really, really carefully. So if you don't have water, there's a lot of mitigation, preparation, test analysis, background data test that you do not have to do. So those two things, the fact that we're on private land working with DOGMA as opposed to public land working with the NEPA Forest Service or BLM, and secondly, that we don't have to do all of this work with water, makes it a much faster process. We think in less than 3 years, we'll be able to turn a shovel on construction for this project, which is relative to Baratrek Arnett, where we know from all the work we've done so far, even though we've already, you know, got going on that, we're still looking at another 3.5 years.
Right. Okay. So you talked about, also you mentioned earlier on about the some of the infrastructure that is in place. Obviously, you know, back where there a while ago. So in terms of creating a facility, a plant using the infrastructure and any other equipment which may or may not be there, that's going to need financing. So this isn't going to be, you know, it's not shovel ready. So can you explain sort of the process for building something which can actually get into production?
Yeah, we don't have quite the same advantage on infrastructure as we do at BearTrack and Merkur. At BearTrack, we have an ADR gold processing facility, warehouses, power to site, solution ponds, all of those things. At Merkur, we don't have the gold processing facility. We do have a paved road to site. We do have power line to site and a transformer station. We do have admin buildings. We do have the same bulk of data, background information on the site. And one of the other big advantages of this project is that it's got a relatively gentle topography, which makes for easier construction. Both of these projects are nearby supportive communities for exploration and mining. In the case of BearTrack, the town of Salmon is an hour's drive away. In the case of Merkur, the nearby town is about, Tooele is about half an hour drive away. So neither of these projects require a camp. Neither of these projects are going to be starved for people. They're both in supportive communities.
Right. Okay.
And that's, you know, as we think about sort of projects that are going to get financed on this next leg, you know, McKinsey came out and with a number of $84 billion worth of capital required in the gold space to fund the future pipeline of projects that are going to be required. You know, if you think about financing that $84 billion, it's going to go to, first and foremost, low-risk geography, Western United States. It's going to go to relatively low-capital, high-return projects, say, taking advantage of existing infrastructure. And it's going to go to those that have meaningful opportunities for resource life extension, because that's how you get maximum value out of the money you expend. We've got all three of those things with these projects.
Right. Okay. And I guess people are going to be looking to, again, you talk about sort of correlations with what's been going on at BearTrack Arnett. It in terms of the grade, it's comparable. In terms of the recoveries, are they going to be recoverable in terms of the met and the recovery work?
Heap leach grade at BearTrack Arnett, 0.74 grams per ton gold. Heap leach grade at Merkur, 0.6 grams per ton gold. So a bit better at BearTrack than at Merkur. But the other things we look at are strip ratio. For example, the amount of waste for every ton of ore that we have to take out at BearTrack, 2.7. At Merkur, 1.7. Recoveries, that's the next thing we look at. About the same, 65% for each of those projects. So overall, I think when you sort of balance everything out, these are very similar in terms of the economics. At BearTrack Arnett, we'll be running at 12,000 tons a day. I think at Merkur, we'll be doing maybe 2.5 times that rate of production. Just because we don't already have the plant there, we can size whatever is optimal for the resource. You kind of think through things, 90 million tons of material, plus or minus 10-year mine life, you want to be mining about 9 million tons of a resource a year. And that's sort of how you kind of, one of the ways that you start thinking about scale of the operation.
Okay. And if I look at BearTrack, it's like, I think the last study put it, this is, you know, NPV of about just over $100 million. Can you remember what you used? Was it 1800
yes.
gold, something like that?
18.
Okay. So obviously we're sitting here sort of 2360 today. Obviously a different environment, but it's, you know, that needs to be because sustained. We need to kind of work out what this new base is. But margins. That's the key to all producers in terms of, you know, what they're aiming for here. Scale obviously is something you've already pointed to, but in terms of where you think the kind of cost structures are in the sector at the moment, do you, commodity price rising, do you expect to see cost base rising, or can we expect to see reasonable margins coming from producers?
Look, we just had the inflation data come out of the U.S. We believe it doesn't get restated, you know, 3.5%. Costs are going up. There's no question about that. I think, though, if you look back at the last 10 years of data in margins on gold projects, it's fluctuated between about 30% and 40% overall. So, you know, we're in that range right now, the upper end of that range right now, with the gold price at $2,300 gold. Bearstrat Garnett specifically, $1,250 an ounce AISC. That's roughly a 50% margin over AISC to the $1,800 gold long-term price that we're using for that analysis. We have to keep, even though gold's at $2,300, we have to keep in mind where the debt providers will finance these projects. And of course, they're thinking on more sustained long-term prices. And that's why we evaluate these projects at $1,800. But you've introduced another topic, which is worth bringing up, which is that the existing producers right now are making scads of money. Every $100 an ounce on a 2 million ounce a year production platform is a couple $100 million. And where does that money go when boards are thinking about the lives of their companies and having this cash on their balance sheet? It goes into exploration, it goes into sustaining capital, and it goes into M&A. And I think those are going to pick up as we see this $2,300 gold price and more continue.
It was definitely a conversation I was hoping to have with you, but let's kind of stick with margin for a bit, because obviously, say, it does great things for the balance sheet for the producers, but then the money needs to kind of cascade through the industry. It needs to start affecting people's perception or the value of companies, and, you know, in terms of developers, in terms of even explore codes as well. How would you counsel investors in that? You know, does it move kind of quickly down through the companies, or are we in for a period of, you know, continued evaluation, not just by the producers in terms of where they allocate the capital, but in terms of the markets, the major funds? I don't think generalists are there yet, but the kind of major kind of specific, you know, precious metal funds.
We're already seeing it in the big caps. I think the big caps are up about 50%, 30% to 50% over the last 6-8 months. So we're already seeing that happen. It hasn't yet happened in the juniors, the developers especially, because the developers are particularly sensitive to cost of capital and availability of capital, because we need a lot of it. Explorers, less so, but then that's a more speculative kind of sector of the market. You could have 1,000 explorers and maybe, you know, 10 will get anywhere. You can have 100 developers and all maybe, you know, 8 or 9 of them will actually make progress. So generally speaking, my observation, the money will trickle down from the senior gold companies, royalty companies that are making lots of money and needing places to deploy it. It'll go to the explorers and the developers. It just takes more time for that to happen. So where are we in that trend right now? I'd say we're halfway there. I don't know how to put a pin on it, but as an example, we're seeing corporates, just some anecdotal evidence of what's happening. We're seeing corporates say to us now, look, we are not going to find a 200,000 ounce or 150,000 ounce production platform ready to go in the Western United States or Canada. We're going to have to be part of making one of those things happen. And so you're seeing them doing that. Barrick itself investing $30 million in a pure exploration play next door to us in Idaho. I think that's a sign of the rationale, the thinking going on there. Let's invest because we gotta make these things happen. They're not just sitting on a plate ready for us to, you know, be served up. So that's one thing that's happening. We're also seeing that I think generalist investors are going into ETF and passive funds, and we're seeing anecdotal evidence of that because those funds are getting more money. We're seeing an increase in the amount of capital going into those being allocated there. Still not into sector specific, investors picking stocks, but the ETFs and the passive money is definitely going up.
Yeah, I know. Look, and I think to that point, you know, we recommend that retail, if you're thinking of investing in junior explorer co, please be aware of the percentage or likelihood of return there. And if you're that way inclined, get into an ETF. Howard, developers is a slightly different ball game. I think the ratio is somewhat different, and perhaps the chance of success is somewhat different. You know, please follow the normal rules of due diligence on that. So I agree with you.
Yeah, and I would just add, like, be diversified. The companies that are closer to production will move more quickly. You know, speaking frankly with you, Matt, we're a little bit further away than some of the other companies you introduce your audience to, but then we're also trading at a lot better value. And so it's a trade-off in your portfolio of, you know, $7 an ounce going to $50 an ounce, but it's going to take 3 years compared to, you know, $40 an ounce or $20 an ounce going to $40 or $50 an ounce, and it's going to take 1 or 2 years. Trade-off.
Right. Okay. And I agree. So for some sort of investors listening in, okay, that's solid advice. I want to come back to you about risk and risk from the perception of the producers, right? They've got to work out where to allocate their capital. And when you're sort of studying, you know, how many advanced development stories there are of a certain size, you know, 5 million plus ounces, there's not too many. But they have a, you know, different profiles in the sense that, and I wonder where you kind of felt that you could get to. You've kind of got the lower grade, but lower execution risk type production there. Is that, you're not everyone seeking high grade complex projects. Is it the simplicity of the operation which people look to, i.e. the de-risking there? Or is it purely about the scale, irrespective of whether it's talking high grade underground or, you know, low grade oxide at surface? I mean, how's the valuation process work?
It all funnels down to NAV, you know, which is at the end of the day, I think what investors need to look at, like at the, you know, there's all these different factors that trickle down into net asset value, discounted cash flow value. We're trying to optimize that, and we're trying to maximize the return between where we are now and getting to that. So that's what we're trying to do, and that's what this transaction accomplishes. Scale is a nice to have, but it's really about the value that you can create, and we can create a lot of value out of heap leach ounces. We know that. We've done that before with Barrick, with Beartrack, our net, and we're gonna do that with Marker, and that's one of the catalysts as we take this project forward. Taking 1.6 million ounces of resource and turning it into an NAV, which we think is going to be bigger than what we already have at Beartrack or Anit.
Okay. And let me come back to part of the equation, which we talked about this at the beginning, which is obviously this money that you're looking to raise, $7 million or whatever you end up actually raising. How do you view where that money goes? The allocation of capital, you've got two projects now. You know, similar but also at different stages. So, I presume you've already thought about that.
We have, and the great thing about that for investors is we are highly focused on high return, near payback opportunities. We now have two assets from which to deliver that. That means we get a better probability of delivering milestones faster, and the split, as it turns out, is roughly 50-50. At Merkur, we're going to be marching forward with the PEA by the end of first quarter 2025. In order to do that, we've got metallurgical column leach test samples in the lab now, ready to start. We're going to deploy our team on the geology side, getting the data organized and taking advantage of all that electronic information, all that paper information, into electronic format that we can sift through, find opportunities around. So that's Merkur moving towards PEA by the end of first quarter 2025. At Beartrack, the permitting preparations are already underway. We're going to do more of that, move that forward, and at the same time, we're going to qualify the exploration upside further. Our guys are itching to get out in the field with mapping. Possibly some more geophysics and geochem work, but all targeted at bringing to light those amazing opportunities south of the main bear track trend, where we've already got 5.5 kilometers of mineralization. We want to start putting data to the next 5 kilometers. And of course, that's going to broaden the attention on the project and the potential around that. So an equal split of money as between each of those projects. We've got some transaction costs, very modest corporate G&A run rate Revival Gold. There's no duplication of teams here. And unlike with a public company, we do not have those excessive executive severance contracts to pay. We don't have a lot of G&A that we have to worry about bringing over to the new company. It's all going to fit within our existing team's preview. Our CFO is going to be running hard. Lisa Ross is an extremely energetic and capable CFO, and she'll pick up some additional duties around the integration. We can handle it all internally from our existing team.
Okay, fantastic. And we're looking to close this one?
End of May.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, look, Hugh, I appreciate you running us through that. I think it's quite interesting because I always say, you know, that those who can do things like this do, and those who can't don't. And I think perhaps this is a moment of a kind of step change for your company, it feels like. If you get this thing over the line, I think it says a lot. It's a venture statement to the market. So well done. We'll see you soon.
Thank you, Matt.